Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research with unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And on our show today, Christy, we're going to be talking with Dr. Stuart Altman about his new book, Power, Politics, and Universal Healthcare, a story of five presidents in 50 years of work.
Yeah, co-written with David Shackman, and amazing that we have both of them here today in the studio with us.
Looking forward to that. And also looking forward to some interesting research that matters that I think can be used.
I certainly do too. The first one is about organ donation. We've got one about food allergy labels.
About brain tumors and dental x-rays. Uh-oh.
And about activity after knee replacement surgery.
Let's talk about the very first research that matters about organ donation and iPod video. First of all, do you have organ donation on your license?
I am, yes.
Yes, I've got it on my license.
Good
too.
For you. High five.
And we encourage patients, but it's not that often that I get a chance to talk with patients about being organ donations. I don't think about it that often, and they don't ask about it that often.
Yeah, well, and it's a decision that you make when you get your driver's license.
Which is why this research looked at, could they increase the number of people who choose and elect to be organ donations by showing them, in this case, an iPod video while they're waiting to get their driver's license?
Important to say that we have more need for organ donations in our country. The need far exceeds the supply. So making a dent in this will save lives. So in the Annals of Internal Medicine, looking to see with this five-minute video show to the people, then they asked to see if they would be willing to be organ donors, and they had to make a choice about that, and they followed people who saw it versus people who didn't.
And 443 people saw the video, and of that group, 84% agreed to be organ donors, and that compares to only 72% of the 509 people who did not see the video. So the video had a significant positive impact on people deciding to be organ donations.
And it seemed to especially be influential for African-American patients who it raised their consent rate by 22 percentage points versus 11 percentage points among the people, among the Caucasian license seekers. So it raised the points more in the African-American group than it did in the white group.
This is an inexpensive intervention, Christy. Annals of Internal Medicine publication. I really like it. I think it's something that could become a standard of care when you go to get your license.
Well, it focuses on stories, people saying, why did they choose to do this? Why was this important to them? And I think that in itself may change the trust element of what we're doing when we.
And you got to wait a long time when you want to get your license. It's not like you get in and out of there quickly. So doing something for 5 minutes like this, unless you're already an organ donor, in which case you probably don't have to watch this video, I think is a reasonable thing to do. Doesn't mean you have to become an organ donor, but it certainly makes it more likely.
Okay, the next one is about food allergy labels. And this is confusing, as is the whole world of food allergy. But this is looking at the fact that the labels that we put on foods are confusing to the general public.
Yes, and this research that was in the Journal of Allergy and Clinical Immunology, they looked at 2,400 people from the public and also people who belong to different allergy registries, as well as those who are kind of advocates, so people who maybe have allergies. And they looked at to what extent they follow the labels, or really look at the labels that are on a lot of these food products about allergies that presumably they or someone in their family has.
And they divided it into the groups of people who are directly affected by food allergy. So that's with at least one family member who had a food allergy, compared with people who are indirectly affected in their household, which means they supply food to other people who have allergies, like students or preschoolers in their environment.
And one of the things they found, which they found, I think, shocking, I'm not so certain I found it shocking, mm-hmm. was that a lot of people who may have someone in their family who has an allergy, that they bought products or said they bought products that may contain trace elements of some of these allergic substances. And they found that really shocking. I guess I would find it shocking if I really thought someone in my family had a really bad allergy. Why would I buy that product if I knew that it had it? On the other hand, maybe I said, they don't do so well when they have nuts, but they don't really have a true allergy. Maybe I would buy it then. I don't know.
Well, and they found that people were more likely to ignore the warning labels if their households were directly rather than indirectly affected by food allergies. And that they seemed surprised by. But to me, it makes sense that if I'm buying food for a bunch of children, some of them have food allergies, I might be more conservative about that and more careful with the labels than if it was just for my own health. And I kind of know, oh, okay, that might upset my stomach, but I'll be fine.
Yeah, I think a take-home message for me, Christy, is if there are warning labels there and I as a parent know my child or a spouse has a true allergy, I think it's incumbent upon me to make sure that I'm not buying that product.
Absolutely. And I do think we have lots of research to do to clarify this and also to improve on those food allergy labels to make it clear. It's hard for families.
I agree.
Okay, let's talk about X-rays.
I've got three kids, so I've been there. And you got two.
I do. And speaking of my children, I think about this when I take my kids to the dentist about dental X-rays. And if you're doing them so young now that we do to young children, what does that do to their lifetime exposure to radiation?
Right. And so the question is, there are different types of X-rays that children can
get. Adults.
And adults. One is where they put X-ray dental plates in the back teeth and look at the places where they're most likely to have cavities develop. Or they may do a panorama where they do an X-ray of the entire spectrum of the mouth and other places in between. And the question is, how often do they have these X-rays? And then does the frequency of having these X-rays translate into a common type of cancer called intracranial within the brain meningioma?
And what they did was they took about 1,400 people who were diagnosed with this type of brain tumor, intracranial meningioma, and looked at them during the time of the diagnosis and found out what their history was.
And they compared that group to a little over 1,000 people who were similar in many respects but did not have the tumor. And what they found is that those who had the tumor were twice as likely as the group who didn't have the tumor to have had the sort of images taken called bite wings, the most common types of X-rays.
But it didn't totally make sense that the small risk association was with the bite wings, which are more focused, and not with the full mouth series, which is multiple bite wings. And also, when you looked at the risk, it only increased the risk from 15 out of every 10,000 people to 22 in 10,000 people. And so we're talking about small risk and risk increase, but still small. So it's really hard to make sure that we're worrying about the right thing.
It is. I think, though, this, if I'm a parent here, Christy, which I have been, and even myself who has to go in for X-rays in my dentist, I do want to ask, how often do I really need these films? And is there any other way to understand my risk of developing cavities or some tooth decay without having these X-rays? Because certainly if you don't have to have them yearly, it's much better. I think most people would agree.
And we need to continue our efforts, as we have done, in decreasing the amount of radiation given in those X-rays, which we've made big progress for.
And this research was in the journal Cancer. Not surprising. Let's talk about our very last research that matters, about activity levels after a knee replacement.
So this has to do with expectations. So what they wanted to find out of what are people's expectations before they have the surgery, especially with respect to how physically active they will be after the surgery. So they interviewed people beforehand and then followed them out a year afterwards to see how active they were.
Right. So they surveyed 83 patients who had arthritis and then were going to have this knee replaced both before and after the surgery. And they reported that they spent about 2 hours a week being active before their surgery, and they expected to spend about 23 hours a week a year later. But then the year later, when they were resurveyed, they spent about 11 hours a week. And I guess, was this a good news or a bad news? They that they spent less time than they thought, but it was five times more than they had been spending.
It was. And there, you know, of course, there's less pain and more day-to-day function that comes with having these surgeries. And also, having a goal of being very physically active is probably more likely to result in you being as physically active as you can be. So the fact that they went from 2 to 11 hours, I think, is very good news.
I think that's great news. I think, you know, if you ask me, How many miles am I going to run in the next year? I've got some really ambitious goals. If I ran half that many, I'd be pretty happy.
It'd certainly be better off than it would if you didn't have the goal at all.
And so, this was in the Journal of Arthroplasty, a hard word to say, but you know what? We like it, and we think that this is a good thing, both for pain relief, if you need it, and for increasing your physical activity level.
So we've talked a little bit about knee replacement surgery, about dental x-rays possibly being linked to a common brain tumor.
That's certainly, if you have allergies, look at the labels.
And about using videos in the DMV office to encourage organ donation, which is an important thing if you're willing to consider it.
That'll conclude the Research That Matters. We'll take a short break. When we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Stuart Altman and David Shackman about their book, Power, Politics, and Universal Healthcare. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Adam and I are going to have a great conversation with health policy experts Dr. Stuart Altman and David Shackman about their book, Power, Politics, and Universal Healthcare.
And we want to welcome to the show today Dr. Stuart Altman, who is the Saul Chaykin Professor of National Health Policy at Brandeis University and has served 5 presidents on healthcare policy and author of numerous books, as well as David Shackman, who's also a co-writer on this current book on Power, Politics, and Universal Healthcare, and is a senior fellow for health policy at Brandeis University and a co-author with Dr. Altman on several books. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much.
We're glad to have you here with us in the studio and are really looking forward to hearing more about the book. It's very approachable and easy to understand with some complex terms. Wondered if we'd jump in and hear a little bit of the story of why you decided to write this book.
Well, I've been involved, as Adam said, since the early 1970s in national health care, and I've finally decided it was time to put something together to sort of knit the various activities I've been involved in to the broader issue of seeing how this country attempts to create universal coverage. And I very quickly decided that I wanted to link up with my sidekick, David Shackman, who's a wonderful writer, and he and I have worked together over a decade. So the two of us set our sights, and we put this book together.
You know, Christy, I had worked with Dr. Altman for 11 years, and I was semi-retired and enjoying myself and having vacations and playing golf. And one morning the phone rings, and it's Stuart Altman on the phone, and he wants to write a book on healthcare. And, you know, Stuart, who's done more for healthcare in the past 4 decades than probably anybody in the country, if he asks you to write a book on health, it's like Tiger Woods asking you to write a book on golf.
You better say yes.
I couldn't refuse, and it ruined my retirement.
How's your golf game?
It's gotten worse because of that.
Well, you know, I guess one of the questions that, as we really are talking about universal healthcare, let's just define for our listeners, what's the scope of what we're really talking about? You've worked with 5 presidents. This has been an issue up until recently that was on the forefront for most presidents, at least in as far as my life has been here. Do we have universal health care in the United States? And how does the United States compare to other countries?
Unfortunately, the answer is definitely no. We are really much behind most other countries. Most every other country, particularly industrialized countries, have some national law that requires everyone to have health care insurance and mandates that it's available and is usually financed through some form of government payment. There's no one way to do it, and every country has it different, but they have some component that makes it universal. In the United States, we've been sort of through time, putting together bits and pieces, and we've put together an extremely complicated health insurance law where some of us are insured by private insurance, some by Medicare, some by Medicare, the VA, or being uninsured. Now we have upwards of 50 million Americans with no health insurance, which amounts to about 18% of our population. And while it varies depending upon the time of year and whether we're in a recession or not, it is not a picture that I think any American can be proud of.
And comparing our country with other developed countries, how does our cost and our health outcomes, which we think we're healthier people, but how does that really compare?
Unfortunately, it's ironic. Here we have 50 million without health insurance, and yet our costs on a per capita basis are twice as high as many of these other countries like Canada or England or even Germany. And the outcomes, much as we think we have the best medical care in the world, and we like to believe that we carefully train our best people to become doctors, like you guys. The truth of the matter is that when we stack up on an international basis, often we're woefully inadequate in a number of important areas, particularly in the area of family medicine, where our primary care situation is much worse than other countries. So on all three grounds, universal coverage, costs, and quality, we need to do better.
Well, I know we're going to get in shortly into understanding a little bit about the history and some of the stories you tell, which are remarkable stories in the book and perhaps unpredictable, like you wouldn't necessarily believe that some major healthcare reform has occurred under the Republican administrations and the Democratic ones were some failures. But you do say at the beginning that our system is hard to coordinate, difficult to change, and impossible to comprehend. And I wonder, Mr. Shagman, since you're a writer and you're co-writing this book, was this a difficult topic to get into for you as well? And was that a motivation for you to want to write this to help make something like this more comprehensible to people, which even as providers, Christy and I find it difficult to comprehend?
You know, we tried very hard to make this understandable. We really wrote this book for a lay audience. And rather than write it like a history book, we tried to tell all the stories through these little vignettes, many of which Stuart was involved with, and little-known stories that people don't know. But the system has become so complicated over the years from trying to build it piecemeal and trying to include all these different populations in insurance that the biggest problem was condensing it to a book of about, I think it's 390 pages. We could have written 1,000.
Right, and I've seen books with 1,000 pages, and they're a little intimidating. Thank you for keeping it manageable, but packed full of stories.
The other element, as we're reflecting on where we are in America and our history and where we're going, is the fact that it's hard for people to understand the complexity of all this, for all of us too. And then there's a lot of fear involved of, and you wrote in there about a conflict between people wanting us to stop spending so much money, but being afraid and not wanting limits. And I wonder if you might put that into context in terms of where we are in the story.
Well, here you can just look at what's happening in this current debate that's going on between the plan that was passed by President Obama and those who are opposed to it. Those who are opposed to it, for many of them, the fear is that somehow this new health reform, which will add most of the 50 million and have some form of coverage, is going to make their life worse. Either it's going to negatively affect the quality of their care, access to their physician, or most importantly, their costs. And so this fear is very real, particularly for those who are the most vulnerable. The irony is that the group that has been most opposed to health care reform are those individuals over 65 covered by Medicare. So here's a group covered by a government plan who are arguing against a government expansion to cover the uninsured. Why? Because they're afraid.
Well, you talk about that, and by most accounts, we would all say Medicare is highly efficient and effective, yet you talk about that Americans are afraid of the system and think that the government is wasteful and taxes too much. So do these things just coexist?
Well, you know, what you're doing, almost 85% of Americans have health insurance. And most of them who have it are pretty happy with the insurance they have. So it's very hard to convince the 85% to risk what they have to help the 15%. And that's a real problem, and that's where you get a lot of the fear.
If you mentioned Medicare. Medicare is a wonderful program. I'm on Medicare, and I just went through two bouts of very expensive medical care, and Medicare paid all the bills. But Medicare didn't help me at all. In terms of navigating the system. Fortunately, I understand the system pretty well and have a lot of good friends who are very quality physicians. So I didn't really need much navigation. But Medicare is better at paying bills, and it is not the most effective way of providing care in a number of ways. We need our financer, whether it's a private insurance or government, to help us as patients. So Medicare is a great program, and I work very hard over my whole life to make sure that it is maintained. But it is also a program that could benefit from a number of important changes.
Well, we do need to take a short break. It's going by so quickly when we have important topics. But when we come back, I hope we'll talk some about these key moments in history that have defined where we are and some of your recommendations of the most important next steps. We'll take a break, but when we come back, we'll continue talking with our guests, Dr. Stuart Altman and David Shackman, about their book, Power, Politics, and Universal Healthcare. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with health policy experts Dr. Stuart Altman and David Shackman about their new book, Power, Politics, and Universal Healthcare. And perhaps just tell us, you know, I guess we, Christy and I, and all of our colleagues just assume Medicare has always been here, but it's not the case. How did Medicare get passed? What happened?
Well, you know, a lot of people think that the Obama health plan was a partisan effort and Medicare was bipartisan. But Medicare was a very tough partisan 7-year battle. And the only way it eventually passed was that Lyndon Johnson ran against Barry Goldwater and had huge majorities in the House and Senate. And most Americans think you get major legislation by compromise between both parties. But that's not the way it happened. We passed Medicare because Lyndon Johnson had a solid majority, and Obama passed health care because he had a solid majority.
You know, it's interesting. If you look back, this was the late 1960s, and the environment was so different than it is today. Even though it was more pushed by the Democrats, the Republicans, too, recognized that government was an important force and was going to go even further. So when Richard Nixon became president in 1968, he faced the very like possibility that not only were we going to have Medicare run by the government, but that we were going to have government run all health care. Now, I happened to go work for Richard Nixon in 1971, and I was instructed by him and his Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare, Caspar Weinberger, to put together a plan that was comprehensive, that worked, but that included as much private insurance as possible, because he very much feared that Senator Kennedy would come up with a true all-government plan. And we put together a plan which, ironically, has been described as the most comprehensive plan ever put forward by a president, even more comprehensive in a lot of ways than the current Obama plan.
And so fast forward to Clinton, the Clinton years, and summarize for us a little bit about what happened there.
Well, that's worked for him during the campaign, and we were originally going to build on that same idea of taking our complicated, confusing system and make it work better. And at the last minute, Clinton decided to totally revolutionize the way healthcare was delivered. And I had a meeting along with others in Little Rock, and unfortunately, I told him that this America was not ready for that kind of a change. He didn't listen to me. I went out, and I was no longer part of his administration. And ultimately, the backlash against this plan was so great that we never even voted on it. And so Clinton, even though he had a big majority as well, he couldn't get it through.
And, you know, we have— in the case of Nixon, you had what you describe as a president that was trying to work across party lines. And in the case of Clinton, there was actually a large Democratic majority at the time, yet they both were not able to succeed. I don't know which one of you decided to tell some what I consider almost humorous stories about some of the reasons why they didn't succeed. Tell us a little bit about the sexual indiscretions and how they actually play in our failure to have national health care.
Well, of course, Nixon was first stopped by this third-rate burglary everybody called Watergate. But then after Nixon stepped down, Gerald Ford intended to pass Nixon's health care program that Stewart actually wrote. And it was going to come up in the fall of 1975, I guess it was. And Wilbur Mills, who was chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, was going to usher it in the beginning of the fall. But before it happened, the police saw a car driving erratically by the Washington Tidal Basin. And they stopped the car, and there was Wilbur Mills with a stripper named Fannie Fox. And she didn't want to be seen. She didn't want to be seen in the car with Mills. So she ran out of the car and she jumped into the Washington Tidal Basin, forever giving herself the name the Tidal Basin Bombshell. And so national health care drowned, and so did Wilbur Mills's career. But it wasn't the only sex scandal that stopped us from getting universal health care, because the Democrats figured after Watergate, they would just take over the government and they would pass their single-payer system. And the person to do it was Ted Kennedy. But Ted Kennedy had run off the bridge in Chappaquiddick, and he felt that he could not lead the party.
Who was
in
with
that
him
election.
In that bridge? What was that story?
Mary Jo Kopechne. Oh, he drove off the Dyke Bridge in Chappaquiddick with this poor girl, Mary Jo Kopechne. And then, of course, I don't think we have to go into the Bill Clinton story.
No, but it's amazing how these sexual innuendos have affected our health in our country.
We tell the people if they don't want to read the book for health insurance, they can read it for all the sex.
Uh-huh.
Well, I know that one of the people interested in this type of what I call a almost a detective story, and it is a story. You describe, Dr. Altman, your mother,
yes,
and I know my mother, who's 85, and her husband, who not too long ago, at the age of 88, had a coronary artery bypass surgery. These are issues that are critical to them and the aging of our entire population. Has that influenced how you see this? Because it's something that you see through a different lens, too.
Well, there's a story which is somewhat apocryphal, but really more true than I like to admit sometime. I was selected then by President Clinton to be on the Bipartisan Commission on the Future of Medicare. This was in early 2000, and we were going to have a vote on this new reform, and it didn't include any prescription drug coverage for Medicare. And that was the one big piece of Medicare that was not covered. And my mother actually called me up and said, Stuart, she said, I've been listening to you on television, and you better make sure that prescription drugs are included. So when the vote came, I told the chairman that I couldn't vote for it. He said, well, there's everything in there. I said, my mother told me that I cannot vote for your plan unless you cover prescription drugs. I also believed it was important that it be included.
You're a good boy.
And I was a good boy, and I voted against it as a result, and it was my vote that stopped the plan from going forward.
Wow. Wow, your mother had some power in that.
And I want to say very clearly that ultimately that led to President Bush putting prescription drugs in. And in 2003, we did cover prescription drugs. So I attribute it all to my mother.
Well, that's you can't ever go wrong with that. And I guess that leads into one question, which is, what have been one of the successes that you really look back on and now writing this book, the successes in healthcare reform, and I assume maybe Obama's vision, because you were originally going to call this book something else, I heard.
Our original title for the book was Failure Again, because we never imagined that Obama could put together the coalition that he did after so many people have failed. So we have had piecemeal expansions, and we had the Children's Health Insurance Program, which Ted Kennedy pushed, which insures a lot of children. But it's been a very difficult battle.
And for a president to take it on, every president that has tried, no matter how powerful they are, it is a very tough card. And as David had pointed out, and there's always strong opposition, particularly at times, and I'm sorry to say that, by organized medicine. The AMA has been against every major healthcare reform until this one. And the reason why is this piece of legislation does not seriously constrain the practice of medicine or lead to serious cutbacks in spending. And so hospitals, doctors, insurance companies all supported it. It is the first major healthcare reform in this country that every major health group supported. In the past, when even Roosevelt, powerful Roosevelt, during the 1930s, when he passed Social Security and was going to do Medicare, he was afraid to do it.
So we won't have time to do this justice, but we will do a segment after this on Behind the Scenes that's available on the blog. But considering all of your wealth of knowledge and experience, you have some recommendations, or what are the key steps for Obama, for others to do to help us be successful in our country?
Well, this is America, and we have to accept it. And I'm proud to be in it. So we are not going to do what any other country has done. And this plan that was put and passed by Obama and the administration is an American plan. Complicated, confusing, maybe not the most equitable, but it brings us very close to universal coverage. Step one. Step two is we really do have to get at the cost of healthcare. We need to do it in a way that does not compromise quality, that improves access. But we cannot, do you realize we're approaching 20% of our gross domestic product, almost $3 trillion spent on healthcare? Those trajectories are not sustainable. So universal coverage, step one. But step two is to try to find a glide path in terms of continued growth in healthcare that we can support.
No, and I know we're going to talk behind the scenes for our listeners who want to hear more. We're going to talk a little bit about the cost equation and perhaps what would happen if Obama's health care law is repealed, and get some of your thoughts on that. But we really want to thank Dr. Stuart Altman and David Shagman, co-authors of Power, Politics, and Universal Healthcare, not only for writing a book that's accessible and relevant to the public, but also for dedicating your careers towards the public good. So thank you very much for being our guest. And also, you are going to be, Dr. Altman, I think, in the community.
Yes, I want to make it clear. I'm also a professor at UNC and the School of Public Health, and it's a pleasure to be part of the Chapel
Hill
community.
Welcome. We're more than excited. But you'll be at the Levin Jewish Community Center giving a public talk on May 15th at 7 p.m., and the public is welcome to come and get a copy of the book and hopefully an autograph.
Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Adam and I are going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns.
You can send us your own comments and questions at yourhealth@unc.edu or download our app, our application, and send us a question by email or by telephone. And we're going to answer a few questions from our listeners today about high blood pressure and headaches.
And a little bit about finding a doctor in your area.
About these more increasingly problems associated with multiple family members living together.
And about Accutane and mood.
Well, let's listen to our very first house call about a scary situation for a spouse.
My husband had something scary happen to him in the shower when he had a severe headache and blurry vision. He has been really stressed for many weeks due to major family issues and starting a new business. He has not been sleeping and has been having headaches on and off. I checked his blood pressure about 20 times during and since the bad headache, and it was 143 over 90 at the time and 115 over 137 for the top number since then. Could it be his blood pressure?
That's scary, all right, isn't it, Christy?
It is scary. And I can imagine, you know, watching your husband be during this time of great stress and problems with headaches and sleep, and then to have something really scary happen like that must be really hard for you as well. In terms of his blood pressure, I think one thing that jumps out to me is that the blood pressure during the time with the headache was a little bit high, but not as high as I was expecting as I heard, you know, the beginning of the story. And so it may be a piece, but since the other blood pressures have all been very normal, that is reassuring that he may have some blood pressure as a component of what's going on in his health, but that doesn't sound way out of the range.
Yeah, what stands out for me more, and I'm sure for Christy as well, are the severe stress that's going on in the mm-hmm. family that we don't even really know about, but the new business and all of the other things that can be going on, like he's not sleeping. And the fact that you checked his blood pressure 20 times, you know, that shows that that's a lot.
And it that shows you're concerned.
That you're really concerned. But maybe we should be focusing on maybe getting him in to see his primary care doctor and letting them reassure you for the things that are worrisome and not so worrisome.
And I think in that visit to your primary care doctor, I would set up the expectation in your mind. This is probably multiple visits to your doctor because the headaches can be coming from the sleep, but having headaches can make you have trouble sleeping. And stress certainly contributes to both problems with bad headaches and with problems with sleep. So, I mean, this is lots of different pieces of the puzzle going on, and it'll really take a relationship with a doctor and taking multiple steps to make headway on this.
I know for myself, if I don't sleep and I get a migraine and get a bad headache, this is a recipe for feeling really bad mm-hmm. on multiple levels. So we wish you well. Thank you for sharing your experience and your question with us. Let's listen to our very next house call, Christy.
I just moved back to the area, and I have a question about finding a doctor. My son has a lot of medical problems, and we have just established subspecialty care at UNC. His specialist said we should get a good pediatrician or family doctor to do his regular care, but I'm having trouble figuring out which doctor and which practice is best for our needs. What is the best way to find a good doctor?
Well, welcome back. Welcome back to the southern part of heaven.
Yeah, well, welcome back. And, you know, glad to hear that you've gotten your son established at UNC with a good care team. And I would agree that having, I know Adam agrees too, that having some primary care doctor, a pediatrician or a family doctor, to coordinate care, to make sure he's getting his immunizations and the preventive piece is very important.
And to find out which doctor and which practice is best for your needs, well, Christy and I, it's real simple. UNC Family Medicine, no. The reality is, you know, once you find a good doctor, I've heard patients say this a lot of times, you know, when I find someone good and they want to tell a lot of people about their doctor, that's great. That's wonderful. And when you haven't had a good experience, then you find a different provider. So you can look and see what your friends are doing.
Mm-hmm. Word of mouth. You could talk to the actual specialists and see if there's anyone that sees a lot of their patients they work closely with. You can think about going and interviewing some people and going. I mean, lots of people do this with me. They'll come and bring their child, or they'll come when they're pregnant and have a visit just to really hear about the practice and learn about values and see if it's a fit.
And who do you want to? Do you want to see the same person that your child is seeing? If that's the case, then you probably need to see a family doctor so that you can have them together, versus if you have your different provider or an internist, then you may not need or desire that. So it really depends a little bit on what your needs are. But hopefully find someone that you like and that will take care of lots of your needs.
And think about access to the record. Someone who has is able to read and coordinate with the doctors for the subspecialty care sometimes has a little more insight than someone who can't access those records. So just one suggestion.
Good tip.
Okay, let's take our next house call question.
My mother lives with me and my 10-year-old daughter. This is not going well. She has medical problems, including brittle diabetes, and she is not willing to help care for herself or do what she's supposed to do. We are in and out of the hospital related to her medical problems, and she is in need of a nurse. Yet, she refuses to go to a facility. Do you have any suggestions?
Wow, it sounds like you are working really hard to take good care of your daughter and take care good care of your mom all at the same time, and that it's really a tough situation.
Well, and we have to assume that your mother's living with you because there's some really serious health problems, and this, you know, what you're doing to help care for her, first off, is admirable, and and Christy and I really commend you and your family there. But it is hard because you have ways of living and eating and structuring your lives that are now completely altered. So we just need to acknowledge that we know that's hard.
One thing that jumped out about this, about whether or not she's willing to help, is making sure that you work with her primary care doctor to be sure she's screened for depression. Depression is really common in people with medical problems and in the elderly. And so if that's a factor, that's potentially something that could be treated that may help her motivation.
And even regardless as to whether or not she has it, I would encourage you to actually seek out maybe a geriatric social worker or a psychologist who works with older people to really help you look into what kinds of issues that may be going on, because there may be multiple issues going on in addition to depression.
So work with your primary care doctor, perhaps with a social worker. Consider, I mean, you can have home health come to the house potentially, and it may require you to hire a private nurse or someone if you have the financial ability to have someone come to the house. But very complex situation, and our heart goes out to you.
Let's listen real quickly to our very last house call.
My daughter just started Accutane, and it's been wonderful for her acne and self-confidence. However, I'm so very concerned about her mood. Every time we have a usual mom-teenager argument, I'm worried that the Accutane is affecting her. She says she's fine and not at all depressed. How often does Accutane affect people's mood?
Well, I'm going to assume that your daughter is a teenager, and first off, this is a hard issue in and of itself with depression and worried about depression and mood in teenagers and hormones. But here you're now talking about acne and then potentially medication. So lots of things going on here.
And there have been a lot of studies about Accutane and teenage depression. Unfortunately, depression is very much linked to the situation of the acne itself. And
much more so.
Much more so than the drug itself. So it can be very hard to tease out. There have been multiple studies trying to get the answer to your question. And the good news is it does work. And it sounds like it's really working to clear up her acne. So that's a good thing.
And at the very least, this is another example where you probably need a little bit of a team approach here. You probably need to potentially, if you have some concerns, have a therapist involved here, coordinating with your primary care provider and or the dermatologist, team approach. And I know that it'll provide some better answers. Good luck.
Thanks for sharing your house call questions today. And thanks everyone to joining us for your health. We hope we've addressed some issues and concerns that are important to you and your health. I want you to email us, go to our iPhone or Android app, visit us on yourhealthradio.org. Lots of ways to reach us.
We'd like to thank WCHL, UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare, and our guests today, Dr. Stuart Altman and David Chackman. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
We can't wait to talk with you again next week.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine and News Talk 1360, WCHL.